This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 27th of October 2009, and today I'm honored to be joined by Lord Monckton of Brenchley. His biography is much too lengthy to do it proper justice here, but suffice it to say he has worn the hat of politician, writer, business consultant, inventor, and served as an advisor to Margaret Thatcher's policy unit in the 1980s. He is an articulate spokesman for skepticism about the perceived threat of anthropogenic climate change. Lord Monckton, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Well, Mr. Corbett, it's a real pleasure to join you, and let me know how I can help.
All right. Well, I understand that you're on a bit of a whirlwind lecture tour at the moment through the U.S. Where are you today?
I'm in New York today doing a series of interviews, and more of them are coming in all the time, requests from all over the world, in fact. And later on this week, I'll be going on Glenn Beck's Hour. That'll be on Friday between 5 and 6 p.m. And then on Monday next, I'm going down to the Sam Houston Racetrack in Texas to address a rally of, I think, around 10,000 people. It's one of these tea parties, which are such a great idea. And I'm going to talk to them, and that'll be the culmination of what has been a six-week tour right across Canada and the United States.
Well, that is very exciting to hear, and it's exciting to hear that your message is getting out to so many people, because I understand you're making quite a stir in the U.S. right now with your revelations about a new climate change treaty that is due to be signed in Copenhagen this December. So tell us more about this treaty and what is so upsetting about it.
Well, certainly. I mean, when the Committee for Tomorrow, which is at www.cfact.org, kindly got in touch with me and offered to organize this tour, we had no idea of how explosive it was going to be, because while I was on tour, Dr. Willie Soon at Harvard kindly sent me a copy of the first draft of what is going to become the Treaty of Copenhagen. And I mentioned this in speeches right across Canada, and it made national headlines there. I was on national TV, and the national newspapers picked it up. And the same thing, but even more explosively, happened when I went to Minnesota as the first major speech on my U.S. tour, because a local television station recorded a few minutes of the end of my speech and posted it up. This was just 10 days ago on YouTube. And if you type in Monckton video, you can now watch that short clip in which I give warnings about the Treaty of Copenhagen, and more than 1 million people clicked on that YouTube video in its first week, and that is believed to be the first time that any political speech has achieved YouTube platinum in under a week, and now it's getting on for 2 million hits, in fact, are on there. So a quite extraordinary response from the public in the United States. And why? Because this treaty, as I explained during that speech, would take away your constitution and replace it with effectively a communistic world government. And I use the word communistic deliberately because there is no word in the treaty draft of anything to do with election, ballots, votes, democracy. That doesn't figure at all. This treaty is designed under the name, of course, of pretending that there is a problem with the climate. It's aiming to set up a world government that will have the power to control all the world's financial and other markets, so no such thing as a free market anywhere in the world, and it will be able to intervene directly in the economic, taxation, and financial affairs of any nation over the heads of any government, whether elected or otherwise, and to intervene in your environment as well. And I have never seen an attempt by the bureaucrats to grab, effectively by a coup d'etat in secret, so much power in one single treaty document. And they buried it very cleverly. There's 200 pages of the usual UN verbiage, most of it meaningless, most of it impenetrable. Every so often, it becomes clear just for a sentence or two. And those are the bits they really want to pass. So that if somebody turns around later and says, oh, well, we didn't realize we'd signed this, the UN will be able to say, well, look, it's quite plain. In the draft, there it says we're establishing a world government. We're not going to have it elected. We're going to give it power to intervene and to enforce its findings and to make you transfer wealth from the richer countries, and that, of course, the chief target of this treaty is America, to third world countries in so-called reparation for so-called climate debt. Now, all of this just at the time when we know that there is no problem with the climate. It's now been proved by direct measurement that the outgoing radiation that was supposed to be being trapped down here by greenhouse gases is nearly all escaping out to space just as it always used to, which means that the warming effect of CO2 is less than 1/6 of what the UN had thought it was. And even if the UN had been right, which we now know it wasn't about that, it would still take 33 years of having no carbon emissions at all anywhere worldwide to forestall just one Fahrenheit degree of warming. So in practice, there's nothing we could do about it anyway. So even though these facts are now known to be the case, Professor Richard Lindzen at MIT has written the paper that brings the scare to an end by replacing all the guesswork of the computer models by straightforward measurement, and a very meticulous and careful measurement it is. That's the end of the scientific debate. There is no longer a climate scare, and yet there is remaining a sort of flywheel effect. So many people have now signed up to the notion that there is a climate problem, that there's a very real danger that unless you, the people of America, can stop this with your love and devotion to your Constitution and your democracy, a very real danger that that treaty will become law, and if it does, that's the end of your constitution, your democracy, your freedom, and your prosperity.
Well, some very powerful statements, and indeed this is a subject of the utmost gravity, so I hope people will look into it. And I assume when you talk about moments of clarity in the dense verbiage of this UN document, we're talking about things like Article 38 of the draft proposal, which states the scheme for the new institutional arrangement under the convention will be based on three basic pillars: government, facilitative mechanism, and financial mechanism. So in your own words, what does this treaty mean by these three basic pillars?
Right, well done. Government means exactly what it says. It means this is going to be a government. It is going to be a world government. If you look at the very next subparagraph, you'll see the word government appears again. And they put that in quite explicitly. Now, I knew they were going to aim to set up a world government in this treaty. I'd known that for a long time because all this was prefigured in the Law of the Sea Treaty that dates back 20 years. And Ron Reagan absolutely refused to sign it because he could see the way things were going. But of course, Bill Clinton, of a very different stamp, having no understanding of the value of preserving your constitution, he signed it. However, the Senate has ever since quite rightly refused to ratify it, and the Senate, I think, would refuse to ratify this treaty too. But the first purpose of it, plainly, is government, and the word is plainly there. Now, the facilitative mechanism, okay, that doesn't seem terribly clear in that little introductory paragraph. You need to read on in the treaty to find out what that means. What that means is that the new government will intervene directly in the economic and environmental affairs of all nations to achieve what are called the climate objectives. And one of these climate objectives, in fact, the first of them, is to transfer wealth, to redistribute, that word occurs in the treaty, to redistribute wealth from prosperous countries like America to the poorer countries. Now, of course, you may think, well, that's a wonderful thing. The poor could do with a bit of help. Not a single penny of the money transferred from the pockets of your taxpayers under this treaty will go to the poor. A large proportion of your taxpayers' dollars, which will be preempted by this so-called facilitative mechanism of this government, will go straight into the pockets of the so-called government itself. They will have their private jets and their vast offices in comfortable places like Geneva. They will trot around the world in just the way that the UN's climate panel does now, meeting in ever more exotic locations at your and my expense and running up an enormous carbon footprint. Not that that matters particularly, but that's where a large chunk of the money will go. Much of the remainder, of course, will do what aid of this kind always does do, and end up in the Swiss bank accounts of various unpleasant dictators and oligarchs in third world countries, whom we should not support, in my view, unless and until they have first become recognizably, properly and stably democratic. And the remainder, what little is left after the world government has creamed off the thick end of it, and then the dictators have taken their cut, will not go to the poor. It will go to building useless defenses against the imagined sea level rise that our climate debt will have caused by our burning fossil fuels, so they say. Now that we know that CO2 has a tiny effect on climate, of course, none of that makes any sense. We haven't caused any damage to the climate, nor are we going to. Our efforts as humans are simply too puny against the vast scale of the climate. We're just not having the effect, the UN has said. So all of these huge public works to defend the Maldives against rising sea levels, where in fact it's now been measured there have been no rising sea levels in the Maldives for the last 1,250 years. But nevertheless, you know, they will be demanding money, allegedly to build defences against it, because all of this will end up in the hands of corrupt contractors and their mates in politics. None of this will go to the poor at all. So we have also, in addition to that, as part of the facilitative mechanism, the right of this government, and again it's made very plain further on in the treaty, to intervene in almost any, in fact in any aspect, of the environmental affairs of any country. Now this could be down to the tiniest detail. They could say, right, there's a particular kind of newt that we think should be protected, because otherwise climate change might put it at risk. And all they have to do is to use that magic word, climate change. And they can interfere in development in your country. They can tell you to reforest or deforest at will. They can tell you where you can and can't have roads. They can tell you what kind of light bulbs you can have. They can tell you whether you can even drive an automobile anymore at all. They will have the direct power to impose these things on your government, whether you have elected that government to do that or not, and whether that government wants to do it or not. And the third element in the treaty is what is called enforcement. That word also appears in the treaty. And what this means is that the wretches who form this new government will have the power to make you comply. It's not a question of making a promise that you will allow 2%, for that's the figure they mentioned in the treaty, 2% of your gross domestic product every year. That's many hundreds of billions of dollars to be transferred to third world countries. If you don't do that, having signed on to say that you will, they can make you do it, and they can fine you unlimited amounts if you don't. Likewise, they can make you comply with any environmental directive that they choose to inflict upon you, and they can fine you unlimited amounts if you don't comply. So we're looking at effectively the abdication of any elected government that signs this treaty in favor of an unelected world government that we cannot remove, cannot hold to account, or cannot replace, and cannot elect. And this is, even if there were a climate problem, and even if we could do anything to mitigate carbon emissions in such a way that it might actually make a difference to temperature, neither of which things is possible or true, then I would still be against the idea of putting control of these matters in the hands of an international body that we did not elect.
So in effect, government really stands for global dictatorship, and facilitative mechanism stands for an enforcement arm for this government through which they can intervene in the affairs of signatory nations, and financial mechanism represents reparations for some imaginary carbon debt sin.
You've got that exactly. That's precisely what this treaty means. It means the end of democracy worldwide, and you will be amazed. You think, well, it's only in a few narrow areas that this world government will have power. But that's not the case. It has, among other things, the power to regulate and control all world markets. Those words are also in the treaty. All world markets, every financial market, every trading market, everything, the oil market, the coal market, the Chicago exchanges, futures market, everything comes under the purview and scope of this new world government. So there will no longer be any such thing as the free market, because all markets will be under the control and regulation of this new world government. It is an unbelievably ambitious treaty. Now, I've had a hand in the drafting, the negotiation, the interpretation of international treaties, and I have never seen anything on this scale before, transferring so much power to a centralized bureaucratic dictatorship. And I use the word communistic because really that is what it is. We're talking of an unelected, supranational, all-powerful government which can totally control all financial markets and all the commanding heights of the economy and of production and all the economy in just the same way as the Soviet Union used to control all those things within its own territory. But this time it will be global. Now, anyone listening to you is going to think to himself, who is this complete lunatic saying all these things and saying and talking about a communist world government? Isn't this appallingly extreme? And I have had people saying that. And I say to them, right, just one thing to say to you, go and read the treaty. You'll find it at www.whatsupwiththat.com. You can register your protest against it once you've read the treaty at www.allpainnogain.org. But everyone who has gone away and has read the treaty has got back in touch with me and said, how dare you understate the threat of this treaty to the extent that you have. It is far, far worse than even you said that it was. That's been the reaction when people have actually read the treaty. And the only people who persisted saying there's no problem with this treaty are those who have not read it or those who mean ill to the West and to America and therefore do not care that it does what I say that it does and what you, on reading it, I think will confirm that you think it does too.
Well, I think some people's incredulity when dealing with this may come from just the ambitiousness of it, as you state. You point out in some of your other talks that this document, of course, talks about government but fails to talk about democracy or ballot. And that begs the question, then, what type of government are we really talking about setting up here, and how do you envision it actually acting to carry out its mandate?
Well, the first thing it will do is that via the UN's financial mechanism, it will preempt resources directly by levy from the pockets of taxpayers worldwide. That's the first thing it will do. It will get itself financially very rich. And when it's done that, it will start spending the money on enlarging itself and increasing its own powers. And it will do this without anyone really seeing that it's going on, without anyone quite realizing how much it's costing. And the various governments that ought to be stopping this have failed to do so. This is the thing that's so extra. The most surprising thing about all this is how far it had got before anyone made it public. Had I not gone public with this, nobody would have known until after it had been signed, and it was all too late, that this was what was in the treaty. And even now that I have brought it to the attention of the American people, now that I have, in some sense, as you may think, created a news story merely by the staggering number of hits that I got on my speech announcing this to the American people, a million hits in under a week, that's a news story in itself. The only one of your major television networks that has been in touch with me to find out more details about this and then to tell its people about it, not to tell them about me, I'm not the news here, the news is what's in this treaty, is Fox News. Nobody else. I've heard nothing from CBS, nothing from NBC, nothing from ABC, nothing from MSNBC, all of them silent, deliberately sulking and looking the other way, sour and sullen silence. Why? Because they had been relentlessly peddling this climate scare for all they're worth throughout the last 4 or 5 years. They have never allowed any alternative point of view to surface on their airwaves. Now that they know that they're wrong, they are simply not prepared to admit their mistake, and they're not prepared, therefore, even to tell anyone, even to inform their viewers that there is this treaty in prospect which would have so drastic effect on your constitution. I find that astonishing. I was a journalist when I started out in life, and my job was to report both sides of every question to make sure that people could then decide for themselves whether they thought the truth was. That's not what happens now. not on CBS, not on ABC. What they now do is they only give you the side of the story that they want to peddle in pursuit of some agenda, which frankly, in this present instance, is deeply hostile to the very country in which they live and move and make their profits. And I find that despicable. And I do congratulate Fox News for having been the one major television network to pick this story up. And I congratulate you, sir, also for having had the gallantry to pick it up and run with it.
Well, it is interesting that you bring up that aspect of the story, because I would venture to say that that in itself is part of the reason why people are turning off their televisions in droves and turning to sources online and places like YouTube for political speeches. So I think this highlights potentially a turning point in the dissemination of political news, and I think that can only be for the good. But turning back to the issues that are raised in this treaty, of course, the idea of a global government is completely unviable if it doesn't have an underlying financial infrastructure, and you've talked some about that, but let's get a little bit more into depth with that. I understand that the cap and trade and the carbon tax schemes that have been proposed, even if one was to believe that carbon dioxide was a poisonous, vile gas that was killing the Earth and not a life-giving fundamental building block of life on the planet Earth, as we know it is, even if one were to believe the anthropogenic climate change scare, of course, these schemes are demonstrably not going to do anything to solve the problem. And if that's the case, what is the real purpose behind these various carbon trading and carbon tax schemes that we've seen proposed and, in some cases, imposed in various nations around the world?
That is a very good question, and let me also add that a worldwide carbon trading scheme is one of the things which is in the Copenhagen Treaty. They are going to inflict this on every nation of the earth, whether the elected governments of those nations want it or not. So this is going to be a worldwide problem. Now, I think the reason that they're doing this is that it gives the dictators complete control over the economies of all nations. If you can say to somebody, if you could say to America, let's take America as the example here. America generates, I think it's 85% of her electricity from fossil fuels. Now, if there is a world government and it wishes to exercise power over America, well, of course, it can use its preemptive power of taxation and just help itself to money from your treasury, because that's one thing that the treaty allows. But on top of that, if it can set a price at which carbon can and cannot be traded, it can effectively, if it wishes to do so, shut down your economy by putting so high a price on carbon that all the Western world's electrical power goes down. And this will not benefit the planet, but it will benefit those forces, and very nasty forces they are too, who have always been bitterly hostile to the success and the liberty and the democracy and the prosperity that we have been fortunate enough to enjoy in the West, and in particular in the United States, which is regarded as the great Satan, not just by the lunatic end of Islam, but also by the lunatic end of the international extreme left. And so they now have their opportunity to shut you down. And I don't think you should underestimate the extent to which the haters of freedom and prosperity, who are nihilists and anarchists at heart, they have nothing to offer the world. They have nothing constructive to give. It's all about tearing down that which they don't think that you and I ought to have and enjoy. They want to tear down our democracy, tear down our prosperity, tear down our economy. And if they can find an excuse to do that, which persuades even our own people that there is this wholly imaginary, as we now know it to be, threat to the planet, and therefore they can persuade us to go along with this, and they can persuade politicians like President Obama, who has surrounded himself with people who either have been or appear to be pursuing communist policies, then you can see that they hope that they will get away with it. They began testing the ground on this with the Law of the Sea Treaty 20 years ago. Ronald Reagan wouldn't sign it, Clinton would. Then they knew that whoever won the election in the United States this time would be a true believer in this climate nonsense, or would at least pretend to be, because John McCain made the second stupidest statement about climate change that I've seen worldwide, and there have been some pretty stupid ones. The most stupid was that of the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom. But nevertheless, both parties went into the last election in the United States saying that climate change was a problem. They said that in haste. They said it because they found it politically expedient. They didn't say it for any scientific reason, for at that time the science had not been settled. Now the science has been settled. The effect of carbon dioxide on temperature is minuscule, and therefore there is no basis for any of this nonsense at all.
Absolutely. Well, I think you would join me in urging the listeners to go and read the draft proposal of this treaty for themselves so that they can come to their own realization about just how incredible this treaty is. But if people do so and then are motivated to ensure the non-ratification of this treaty, what actions do you think will be most productive? And are there any groups or websites that you would recommend for the listeners to go to?
Yes, certainly. The first thing that you should do is get in touch with the White House by email or by telephone. Nothing has more effect in penetrating the minds of those who, at least for the moment, are still subject to your democratic will than you telling them exactly what you think. Ring the White House, that'll have more effect than emailing. Email the White House, that will have more effect than writing. Write to the White House if you can't ring or email. But make sure that your opinion is registered there. And do the same with both of your state senators. It doesn't matter what party they belong to. Write to them anyway, but preferably telephone, or if you can't telephone, email. Those are the two things that have the most effect. I was in on the Capitol Hill just the other day talking to one of your senators, and he and his staff both said they'd already begun to receive surprisingly large numbers of phone calls and emails about this issue. And the more you do that, the more the Senate, which has to ratify this dismal Copenhagen Treaty by a two-thirds, probably 67 votes in its favor in order for it to pass. If you get on to your senators and you make absolutely plain what the scale of this monstrous treaty is, and that it would be unthinkable that they should sign away your democracy by ratifying this treaty, if you make that plain to them, that will help a great deal. And the final thing that I'm setting up is I'm trying to put together a document called an Instrument of Repudiation. And this will be for ordinary people to sign. It'll start off by saying, we, the people of the United States of America. And it will go on to say that we don't believe in climate change anymore because it's now been disproven. We don't believe in the Copenhagen Treaty. And we will remain free. And that instrument of repudiation is only going to be one page long. It's very simple. That will be posted up. I don't yet know where, but possibly at www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org, which is the website where I publish a lot of my stuff on the climate. Or you may find it also at www.cfact.org. That's the environmental group, the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, which takes a very different line from most environmental groups in being sensible about this climate issue. And you will then be able to sign. You'll be asked to give your email address and your name and your full address so that we know that it's you. And that way, we hope to get literally millions of signatures that I can take with me to Copenhagen between December the 7th and December the 18th, while this treaty is being negotiated, and tell the people there of all nations that the people of the United States will not stand for this treaty, and this treaty shall not pass. So those are some of the things I think you could do.
Well, I think the instrument of repudiation is a particularly exciting idea because at least it can demonstrate the fact that this is a completely non-democratic process and that the people's voice is not being heard. And the more we can demonstrate that there's no way for the people to have an input in this process and that the people's voice isn't being heard, and the more we can discredit the system, the better chance we have of really effectively opposing it, I think. So, Lord Monckton, do you have any final thoughts for the listeners today before we leave?
Well, what I'm going to do is to read to you the paragraph from the draft instrument of repudiation, which covers the point about democracy that you've just mentioned. We will never be governed by any but them whom we have freely elected, may freely hold to account, and may freely replace. And we will have no unelected, unaccountable, irreplaceable world government set atop of us, or above our beloved constitution, or over any of the free nations or free markets of the world, and government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Excellent. Well, very stirring words, so I'm very much looking forward to that. And tell us about your website one more time. What's the best website for people to access your work?
If you go to www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org, that's the one to go for, where we hope we'll have this instrument posted shortly. It's just being arranged at the moment because we've got to set up a facility for taking signatures and so forth. That's all being worked on just now. In the next few days, that should go live. And so keep an eye on www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org.
Excellent. Well, I'll certainly be keeping an eye on that and on your work in the future. So best of luck to you. And Lord Monckton, thank you very much for the generous use of your time today.
A real pleasure, and God bless America. We will remain free.